Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. A new book by author Robin Wright promises to increase our understanding of the tumultuous revolution that overthrew the Shah of Iran 2 decades ago. It was, she argues, a revolution as important as the landmark upheavals of the French and Russian uprisings. Most significant is the fact that Iranian society has undergone a profound transformation over the past 20 years. Now, this evolution of the revolution may have profound implications for the future of Iranian-American relations and for the nascent democratic aspirations of other Islamic states. My guest is Robin Wright, author of The Last Great Revolution. Robin, welcome to Dialogue.
It's nice to be with you.
It's great to have you here. And quite frankly, it was a fascinating experience to read your book, and a very timely one, because as we sit here, Iran is undergoing an extraordinary round of elections, which is, in a sense, the very first question, Robin Wright. This round of elections, from all the accounts, and I don't think the tally is quite complete yet, but it seems to indicate that the reformers have made astounding gains in the Iranian parliament and in the city of Tehran. I guess as a first question, is this outcome, in your mind, in a sense, validation of the points you were making in this book, The Last Great Revolution, of where this revolution seems to be going?
Well, the victory by the reformers is the continuation of a trend that began in 1997 with the election of President Khatami. And it really is the final phase of the revolution as it returns to a normal state. It's not just validation of what I wrote, but in fact confirms the pattern of revolutions, whatever the idiom of political expression, be it democracy, communism, or Islam, they all move in a similar path. Mm-hmm. And at the end, there is a return to the kind of normal values, the normal priorities, rather than the militant ideological purpose that usually defines the opening stage of a revolution.
Robin, you in the book, in the very title, make a point of calling this the last great revolution, and you put it in some pretty awesome company. I mean, the French Revolution, the Enlightenment, which, among other things, helped create our nation, the Russian Revolution at the beginning of the century. Why do you give it so powerful a place?
Well, the French and the Russian revolutions introduced new ideologies that were later adopted or adapted by virtually all countries in the world except for the 53 nations of the Islamic bloc. And Iran's revolution did for that part of the world what the Russian and French revolutions did in terms of introducing the idea of empowerment, introducing a new idiom of political opposition, and an idea about what to create as an alternative. Now, that doesn't mean that Iran's revolution is a success, or that particularly the original vision of the revolution is going to be a model for anyone else in the Muslim world. In fact, when you look at what happened to the fate of the Russian and French revolutions, you see that, you know, they imploded. But they did create seeds. They did topple monarchies. They did pave the way for eventual democracy. And I think that's what Iran's revolution is doing. Who knows whether it will evolve into something that is a normal state or whether it will implode eventually, largely probably for economic reasons rather than ideological reasons, mm-hmm. and people will try to look for alternatives. But it will be democratic. Iran is on that path. And in stark contrast to the early days of the revolution and its militant ideology, which was rejected by everyone else, I think history may actually look back on Iran's revolution and say that was the turning point.
Yeah. Tell me something, Robin. And I hope I didn't get this wrong in reading the book, because I was much taken by it. This whole notion of from the start of the revolution, you mentioned three phases. It progresses through. From the opening phase, 1979, when things were being determined, was it inevitable or even predictable that this would become the kind of theocracy or political papacy that it did, at least for a decade or so?
Very good question. In fact, the revolution at an early stage was hijacked by a minority of clerics. There was an array of different groups, nationalists, even communists, who marched alongside the religious element in challenging the Shah's regime. It was only after the revolution that the clerics squeezed the others out, and it was a very bloody period. We tend to remember that first tumultuous decade in terms of the attacks on the West, when in fact it was very bloody at home. Mm-hmm. a president, a prime minister, and 27 members of parliament, as well as 1,000 senior officials, were murdered during this period of purges and the struggle for power. And of course, that was also the decade when Iran faced 8 years of war with Iraq, which I think gave the clerics the kind of national issue that helped them stay in power. I think a lot of this would have happened earlier if it hadn't been for the kind of crises that the clergy could exploit to stay in power. We, again, look at the taking of the American embassy from 1979 to 1981 as something that was anti-Western. Well, in fact, I've interviewed the kids who are now adults who seized the embassy, and they originally intended to take it for 3 to 5 days to protest the Shah's arrival in the United States. They were flabbergasted when Ayatollah Khomeini backed them, and one of them even complained that he had to drop out of university, so he had to go every day to the American embassy to deal with the hostages. But the government wanted to use it as the kind of effort to get people behind them to say, see, we're standing up to the United States. We're the only ones who are going to get the Shah back or make a statement. And that was the period they also managed to pass the Constitution and consolidate their own power, and they used it for their own gains. The same was true of the Salman Rushdie edict. Ayatollah Khomeini's son admitted to me that no one in the family had ever read The Satanic Verses, a controversial book because of a section on the Prophet Muhammad. But again, it came at a time that the revolutionary fervor was flagging. This was the kind of issue that had exploded in India and Pakistan and other Muslim communities. And Ayatollah Khomeini exploited it and jumped on the bandwagon and then died. So that left it out there hanging. But this has been a repeated pattern of a small core of clerics who've retained power. Because the irony, ultimate irony of the revolution, the world's only modern theocracy, is that the majority of clerics have always opposed the system that was installed in 1979.
That also is fascinating. It's, you know, the three great crises of the hostage taking and, well, the war with Iran and Iraq is a crisis of a different sort of and magnitude. And then finally the Salman Rushdie incident. All were seized upon, is what you're telling me, by that. And for Americans, we seized upon, in a sense, the hostage incident as one way of characterizing Iran and the revolution. At least I think in the popular mind, it sort of got it fixed that way. But, and here's what I'm driving at, Robin, it seems to me that we've systematically overlooked an earlier date which made a lot of the fervor possible that led to that, and that's 1953. And I think you almost have to say a word about that for an American audience just by way of remembering what we've forgotten.
Well, it's an excellent question. And when you talk to Iranians today about bettering relations with the United States, the majority are overwhelmingly in favor of it, but they all get back to 1953. This was the time, well, first of all, Iran's revolution was always about empowerment. And twice earlier in the 20th century, Iranians engaged in major movements to try to oust the monarchy, to end 2,500 years of kingly rule. And the first was in 1906 to 1911, the constitutional revolution. That wasn't a revolution at all, in fact, but it did diminish the powers of the king, introduce a parliament and a constitution. That monarchy eventually faded out. Then the Pahlavis, an illiterate army officer, crowned himself king, a kind of Napoleonic act. And he and his son were the last two kings.
Was that with British help, by the way?
They created yet another dynasty. And in 1953, there was a nationalist movement, a coalition of four different parties, that eventually forced the Shah to flee to Rome. And Iranians thought they'd finished the monarchy. But the CIA and British intelligence orchestrated a kind of counter movement. And within a week, the Shah had returned to the peacock throne. Well, having seen two strong, overwhelmingly popular evolutionary movements aborted, Iranians eventually turned to revolution in 1979. And many of them are bitter about the United States. First of all, about blocking the 53 effort, which was legitimate, popular, but also because that forced then Iranians to take to the streets and engage in a revolution that was extremely costly. And they still hold the United States accountable for that. And I think it's actually been referred to in the past year by President Clinton, who's basically apologized for U.S. intervention.
That apology was rebuffed, though, or at least not publicly commented upon in Iran, was it?
Well, deemed as not enough to win in the United States' favor. There's still a lot of outstanding issues on both sides.
But that's the direction Iranians want Americans to to go, though, to recognize what was done and to try to redress that.
That's one of several steps. I think one of the other things is they would like to see an end to the hostage crisis because their assets are still frozen in The Hague 20 years after the end of the hostage crisis. And that's one of the big outstanding issues between the two countries.
There are so many outstanding issues to talk with you about, Robin. Let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA. My guest today is Robin Wright, author of The Last Great Revolution, Turmoil and Transformation in Iran, just out and published by Alfred A. Knopf. Got all that right. Robin, I want to turn to some of the personalities that are so fascinating behind this because we've at least briefly been able to touch upon the political figures, some of them. But to me, the intellectual and theological figures who work in Iran have been at work for some time in this process of defining what Islamic democracy means are equally important, if not in many ways more so. We're introduced to a man, Abdul Karim Sarush, who I would like to meet someday because it seems to me that he is truly an original thinker. And he is one of the people who has been able to, when I use the word flexible, I don't mean in any sense spineless, but suggest that there are reinterpretations of Islam that will make liberalization possible and seemly within the Iranian context. How does he do that?
Well, Sarush is called by many people the Martin Luther of Islam because he does something that is just as important. He is taking Islam into a period of reformation that is as important to the broader Islamic world as the Reformation was 400 years ago in the West because that gave birth, as you said earlier, to the Age of Enlightenment and the ideas behind modern democracy. And he does it in ways that are accessible to the public. He says things, for example, like, to be a true believer, whatever your religion, you have to have come to that religion freely, of your own will, not to have it imposed or inherited. Therefore, freedom precedes religion. And that kernel is the seed for all other freedoms. He also says that an Islamic state can't be imposed unless there are total freedoms that accept and elect an Islamic state. It's not legitimate. And finally, he says that any Islamic state, any religious state, in fact, without total, unqualified, unconditional freedoms is dangerous because it leads to totalitarianism. And he also says, for Muslims in general, there is no single path, which is the phrase in Islam, that it is possible to modernize interpretation, to make it adaptable to current conditions, that the Prophet Muhammad never intended to have a vision that would apply throughout history, knowing that times change. And his ideas have really provided the groundwork for all of these reformers to emerge. President Khatami was one of his colleagues and followers, as are many of the people who have opened newspapers and magazines, which are at the forefront of defining the public debate in Iran today. And in some ways, I think the Islamic Reformation that is coming out of Iran will be far more important than anything politically in terms of its legacy and in terms of its historic value.
With that comment, let me go into the question about as you put it, the potential for the historical legacy of this Islamic Reformation, the potential that as a new philosophy, a new way of interpreting Islam and democracy, it can influence the other 50 or so Islamic nations in the world. Now, Robin, that owes to the power of people like Sarush. It owes to the fact that Iran is a millennial civilization with deep cultural roots. I mean, people didn't start this yesterday. But on the other hand, it seems to me it's somewhat constrained by the fact that Iran is a Shiite Muslim nation, is it not? Or is that, I mean, how far can this go? And how important are factors like the Shiite versus Sunni distinction?
It's a good question. As I said, Iran is the only Shiite country that dominated and ruled by Shiites in the Middle East or anywhere in the Islamic world. And that's one of the main reasons that the Sunni Muslim states have been less interested. And the interesting thing also is it explains why Iran went through a revolution and the others haven't. Shiite Islam differs because they have a hierarchy, much like the Catholic Church. You have clergy who are empowered to interpret law and society for the faithful. You have people who are the equivalent of a pope and bishops. Whereas Sunni Muslims are more like Protestants because the clergy acts as guides, advisors, but man's relationship with God is direct, whereas a friend of mine compared it once to a telephone. You use direct dialing if you're a Sunni, and you go through an operator if you're a Shiite.
That's great.
But it helps explain that why the clergy was so powerful in defining the revolution. The Shah had banned and exiled and, you know, all the major opposition groups, and so in looking for an alternative, Islam was the only thing that was legitimate and viable. And that's why the clergy ended up playing such an important role, because it didn't start out as a religious revolution at all.
You know, one additional thing about the Shiite Sunni history that I found important, particularly for those in positions of policy making vis-a-vis Iran, and do correct me if I'm wrong on this one, because it was something I thought was very compelling, that Shiites have a sense of persecution. That it's not just, that, I mean, the proportions are disparate because I think the Sunnis are far greater in number than Shiites. Is that right?
Yeah, they're about 80%, 80 to 85% of the Islamic world.
So only 15% are Shiite to begin with. And then, of course, this all traces back to the descent from the Prophet, does it not? The line of Hussein and questions of orthodoxy relating to that.
The split within the Muslim world goes back to the 7th century and the issue of leadership.
Yeah.
After the Prophet Muhammad's death, there was a major dispute between those who were close to him and his wider family. And the family believed that they should be the ones. They knew what he believed and what he wanted and the way he had lived his life. And they believed that that leadership should descend through
right.
his children or those who were of blood relation. Whereas some of the advisors and people who joined the new Islamic world then believed they should be the ones to interpret. And there was a major split. And those who became Shiites, Shiite means follower of Ali. And to shorten a long story, the grandson of the Prophet, the son of Ali, who believed that should be the line of descent, ended up challenging the new Umayyad dynasty. Even though there were only 73 men and women and children, they decided it was better to live or better to die fighting for justice than to live with injustice. Mm-hmm. And so even knowing that they would be massacred, so that created this sense of persecution and always being outside, always having to try to right wrongs. And that has, again, been a defining component of Iranian society, of the Shiite world, and most recently in the way the revolution played out. They always felt that the Shiites were persecuted by the West. You know, always that deep underlying suspicion and looking at everything.
Mm-hmm. Once again, I'm glad I asked it and gladder yet that I got that response, because I'm a deep believer that today has roots in yesterday, you know, and that culture and history are powerfully determinant. And I think it's important for us, if I get the direction of what you've been saying, Robin, that this country, Iran, is certainly a regional power. There's no question about its size and its importance in so many ways. And yet it has this sense of persecution, this sense of vulnerability, and this unwillingness to put up with what it considers injustice or to rebel against it, which are, I think, things that must be taken into account.
Well, and you said history. This is a culture, a culture that dates back 4,000 years. Yeah. That's not something that we can shake our fists at, right?
Yeah, absolutely not. The book covers so many things. I mean, there's some marvelous descriptions of Tehran, Isfahan, Shiraz, and other Iranian cities, all of them extremely valuable. And this, too, which I find merits a great deal of our attention, because at long last, and appropriately, and I do emphasize at long last, policymakers and others are beginning to understand the status of women as an important barometer of what progress means in any society in the world. And in the case of Iran, that is also has been problematic for Westerners to understand. The image of the chador is the one that we sort of take as a symbol of persecution and oppression. But from the book, once again, there are complexities here.
Well, when the mullahs came to power, they introduced something that was equivalent to gender apartheid. And again, lowering the marriage age to 9 and withdrawing a lot of the rights that women had been granted in an earlier constitution. But the women represent what I call the revolutions within the revolution. And there, again, are the real legacy of Iran's revolution, because people went out and got the doors open wide enough that women and others went out and got what the system wasn't giving them. And women began to fight back. And interestingly enough, it was facilitated because the revolution actually brought a lot of traditional families into the system, people who hadn't been political, people who hadn't sent their daughters to school because they didn't trust the Shah's regime not to taint them. They began to trust. And as a result, female education has just skyrocketed. The UN recognized Iran last year as one of the 5 countries that has done the most to narrow the gap between male and female education. And literacy in general went from 58% to almost 90%. And women today are doctors and lawyers and architects and members of parliament. There are more women in Iran's parliament today than there are in the U.S. Senate. 500 ran for the 290 seats of Iran's parliament on Friday. There's a woman vice president. Women have changed laws. They've lobbied and campaigned. Now, that doesn't mean that there still isn't discrimination. A woman can vote as an equal in parliament. She can sit among her peers equally as a vice president. There are 7 vice presidents in Iran. But she has to have the written permission of her husband to leave the country. She can have the star billing in a movie, but she has to stand in the back of the bus. So there are some bizarre regulations still, but I think these are some of the things that you'll begin to see changing. I think we in the West probably look at the chador or the Islamic dress, which is also being becoming more moderate, and we equate it with the women in Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan, when in fact nothing could be more different. The Iranian women are among the most empowered in the Islamic world today.
First of all, among the women who are doing these things and holding professional distinctions are the daughters and granddaughters of Ayatollah Khomeini, as I understood from the book.
Absolutely.
So this is, no small matter. Also, I got, just by way of personal enlightenment, a kind of a different take on the chador from the book. I'd never thought of it this way, and it's not that I say one way or the other is right to think about it, but I think at least one woman, perhaps several, mentioned it as a kind of a she'd certainly accepted it, liked it, and I think culturally would want to use it anyway, that it forced the society to look at her, she said, not as, for any question of attraction, but rather for what she was able to do functionally in her professional post. And that, as I say, is a viewpoint worth considering.
And women also tend to feel safer. I have to wear Islamic dress. Now, I don't wear anything serious. I wear a scarf loosely tied under my neck and a baggy coat. But it is the fact that women are to be treated well, the idea that has prevented a lot of the kind of nasty crime that we see so often in the West. I feel safe actually walking anywhere and doing anything in Iran at any hour of the day or night.
I pause in silence at hearing that. Something we should think about. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. Robin Wright's a fascinating book. I want to conclude, as I told you earlier, with a blue sky question. It's so often the case that people in conversations like to hyperbolically refer to pivotal moments and great crises and turning points, crossroads, and you name it. But we are at that. I mean, legitimately, with this most recent election and the direction it's taking, and the fact that in this country we've got a presidential campaign going on. All of which taken together point to the possibilities of new directions, new starts. We've talked about the effect that Iran's intellectual legacy can have throughout the Islamic world. But in concluding, I'd love to get your thoughts on what any incoming American administration could do in terms of seizing the best aspects of this moment, moving ahead in terms of what's possible for a better relationship. And that relationship, quite frankly, is essential for us, I think.
Well, it's not just an issue of policymakers. And there was a public opinion poll done in this country recently, and it showed that Between 80 and 90% of Americans are ready to resume relations and even to compromise on one of the key issues in order to renew relations. And in Tehran, every Iranian I know, whatever their politics, believes it's time to get that relationship back on track. Needless to say, both sides have issues. But there is now a will like you've never seen before. And in fact, the first American tourists are going over there. One of my favorite passages in the book is about going to Khomeini's tomb and seeing busloads of American tourists there. I think President Clinton has, over the past year, tried to explore the possibility of renewing relations and at one point thought that Iran might be his China, that he might bring down that wall. And I think President Khatami in Iran has taken an initiative by calling for people-to-people cultural exchanges to help end the wall of mistrust. It'll be interesting to watch in the remaining months of the Clinton administration to see if there is the potential for movement. I think Iranians want it, and one of the interesting things on the eve of the revolution was the number of candidates who said, let's have a public referendum on relations with the United States. The last generation decided to turn them off. Let's see how people feel now. Some legitimizing means of getting past that hurdle. But at the same time, the Iranian government wants to move slowly. I think there's an awareness that the reformers won, but they're not going to dash to do everything in the next 5 months. Mm-hmm. They've got 4 years of parliament. President Khatami faces re-election for his second and final term next year. So the next 5 years, we'll probably see the kind of change that we in the West. But Iranians don't want another revolution, and they also don't want the kind of backlash that will divide society. So I think there'll be a genuine effort to do things slowly, and issues at home will always come first. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we should have any illusions necessarily that by the end of this administration, we're going to be back on track. Maybe some first tentative steps that would be, I think, welcome in Tehran, but nothing final.
But it does call for our engagement, our patience, and our sympathies, I think.
Yes, and swallowing the past.
Wonderful. It's true. Robin Wright, thank you so much for being with us on Dialogue today. The book is The Last Great Revolution. I recommend it without reservation, and look forward to talking to you again.
Wonderful to be with you.
Thank you. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Robin Wright. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production assistant is Kirsten LaCour-DeBelco. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.